I'm Kerry Curtis, a member of the club's Board of Governors and co-chair of the Environmental Forum. It's my pleasure to introduce our two speakers tonight, Jared Blumenfeld and Jacob Scher. They worked together 20 years ago or so at the NRDC, Natural Resources Defense Council, and I was privy to about a half hour's worth of good-natured kidding back and forth about what went on those days, which was immediately after the original Rio summit. Jared Blumenfeld was appointed by President Barack Obama as the EPA Regional Administrator for the Pacific Southwest in November 2009. During this time at the EPA, Jared has taken significant actions, among them designating the Los Angeles River as protected under the Clean Water Act and protecting over 5,000 square miles of California's coastal waters. Prior to EPA, Jared was director of the San Francisco Department of the Environment, where he pioneered landmark environmental standards. Jared received his law degrees at the University of London and the University of California at Berkeley. Go Bears. And Jacob Scher is director of global strategy and advocacy in Washington, D.C. for the Natural Resources Defense Council and has been with NRDC for over 30 years, which has got to make him one of the longest tenured employees at that invaluable institution. It's funny how he doesn't look that old, though. Prior to his current position, Jacob was NRDC's senior attorney for international programs and has seen NRDC's worldwide expansion, including offices in China and India. When he is not trying to save the planet, Jacob enjoys his family, friends, biking, skiing, and photography. And Jared and Jacob will both be at the Rio Summit next June. And so our first speaker of the two will be Jacob Scher.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Good evening. It's great to be here. I want to thank Ann Clark for putting this together, and I want to thank Kerry for that kind introduction, and I would thank my old friend and former colleague, Jared Blumenfeld, for joining us this evening. It's great to be back in San Francisco. The last time I was here was at the end of August, where I had this unusual experience of actually experiencing an earthquake back in Washington, D.C. while I was here. So it was kind of interesting today to finally, this is the first time in my life that I've actually experienced an earthquake, so it was good to have the earth move a little bit for me being here in San Francisco. And I want to thank all of you for coming tonight, and we're going to be talking about the Earth Summit, which is going to occur in Rio de Janeiro next year. The Brazilian government right now is getting prepared for hosting about over 100 presidents and prime ministers and some 50,000 people at a UN conference, which is officially called the Conference on UN Conference on Sustainable Development. And the purpose of the meeting really is, the major overriding purpose of the meeting is to really stimulate renewed political commitment to the concept of sustainable development and to really stimulate real action to move us towards a sustainable future. Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General of the United Nations, says that the so-called Rio Plus 20, and the reason it's called Rio Plus 20 is it will also be the 20th anniversary of the first Earth Summit, that this meeting is probably one of the most important meetings in the history of the United Nations. What I want to start off a little bit about is talking about sort of really the fact that human beings are sort of at a crossroads. We really have been extraordinarily successful, perhaps the most successful species on the planet. And if you believe that we were meant to go forth and multiply and subdue the Earth, we have done that. We've seen actually the population of the planet almost double since World War II. And on October 31st of this year, it is now estimated that we will reach the 7 billion mark. And that number could go up by another 2 billion by 2050. We've also seen a huge increase in economic activity, particularly since World War II. There are more people living better today on the planet than ever before. And one indice of the tremendous advance in the economic sphere is the introduction and use of automobiles. In 1950, there were just 50 million cars on the planet. Today, there's close to a billion, and some people are projecting that we'll go to 2 billion in the next 15 years. So that's a huge indice of real progress and activity. This has created a huge amount of pressure on our natural systems, and many of you are familiar with these sorts of statistics, and there are many more, but just wanted to pull out a few to sort of illustrate the fact that we are, as human beings, putting a lot of pressure on our Earth. This is kind of – it was interesting. Apparently, there's been a calculation that today there are about a third fewer wild animals on the planet than there were just 40 years ago, and that the rate of extinction is about somewhere between 50 and 100 times what would be considered the normal or natural rate. Just in the last four decades, we've lost about half the tropical forests on the planet, and it's clear now that we are actually warming the atmosphere of the Earth and acidifying the oceans as a result of the continued and growing emissions of greenhouse gases. We've been talking about the relationship between human needs and the environment at the international level for about 40 years, going back to the early 70s, and I think sort of the high point of kind of concern and real hope in this whole arena was the Earth Summit in 1992 in Rio de Janeiro. This is a picture of that summit. For 2 weeks, Rio de Janeiro was the environmental capital of the world. It attracted the largest number of heads of state and heads of government in history, including our president, George H.W. Bush. And it was an extraordinarily productive meeting. It resulted in two treaties, the Climate Change Treaty and a treaty on biodiversity, an action plan called Agenda 21, which is a 400-page blueprint for sustainable development. It includes about 40 separate chapters, about 4,000 recommendations about what countries should do to become more sustainable, to balance out their economic, environmental, and social equity issues. And also resulted in the creation of a number of new institutions, including the UN Commission on Sustainable Development, the purpose of which was to monitor and support the efforts of individual countries to move towards sustainability. And also the creation of the Global Environmental Facility, which many people have never heard of, but it's a green window at the World Bank, which has actually provided billions of dollars of assistance to developing countries over the last 20 years to deal with issues like climate change and protection of oceans and toxics. Jared Blumenfeld came to work with NRDC with me in 1993, and we conducted one of the first surveys that was ever undertaken of the actual impacts of one of these international meetings. And what we found was that the Earth Summit really did stimulate attention and action on sustainability all over the world. In the end, about 86 countries actually went ahead and created their own national Agenda 21s, and we were actually able to document in many, many countries where there were new programs, new policies, new agencies that were created in the years following the Earth Summit. It also stimulated a lot of activity at the city level. All of a sudden, a lot of cities started looking, in a sense, ahead at that point 10 or 15 years and trying to develop new policies and programs through Agenda 21s. And then also, if you look back to the early 90s and to the summit, it really stimulated a lot of businesses to start thinking about a triple bottom line, to go beyond just looking at profits, but also to look at their social and environmental obligations. And then the final aspect of this meeting, and there are at least a few of you here that are old enough to remember the Earth Summit, was that it really did capture the attention and imagination of people around the world. And I've met over the years many, many people who said I was in high school or college or graduate school, and it was the Earth Summit that got my attention to environmental issues and really had a major impact on the course of my career. Unfortunately, what was clear that by the late 90s, and this is what this cartoon reflects, is that the focus on the environment, the focus on sustainability had diminished, and that too many politicians said, well, I went to the Earth Summit, isn't that enough? And there wasn't the kind of follow-through that we wanted. And part of the problem is, and there are a lot of reasons that people could pose about why people haven't followed through, but a lot of it really has to do with governance problems in many countries and really, at the end of the day, kind of a lack of a political will to follow through. And also, it's a reminder that treaties and plans of action that are adopted at the international level, that's only the beginning of the process. They're not self-executing. You know, they really require national action and below. And so I think that it was quite clear by the late 90s that while there had been progress in a number of areas, that overall there was a big gap between the level of commitments that were made in Rio and what was actually happening on the ground in countries around the world. All right, so now the question is, how do we think about this meeting coming up next year, the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit? And I, you know, I was really inspired by these words from Wangari Maathai, who passed away in the September. Wangari Maathai was an environmentalist in Kenya. She was the first environmental activist to win a Nobel laureate, become a Nobel laureate. And she said, you know, today we're faced with a challenge that calls for a shift in our thinking so that humanity stops threatening its life support systems. And what we really need to do is really think through all the changes that have occurred since 1992 and in our world, so that as we move forward towards Rio Plus 20, we learn from the lessons of these earlier summits and make sure that this is a summit that truly is going to get us on a path towards real action, towards sustainability. So what I want to talk about very quickly are some of these sort of fundamental shifts that we have to make in the way we think about things. First is we really have to start, we have to realize that we're actually bumping up finally against the capacity of our planet to absorb our pollution and to meet our needs. And this is a chart that sort of illustrates this notion of kind of planetary boundaries, and it makes it clear that in regard to biodiversity loss, we're simply kind of exceeding what would be kind of the capacity of the planet. And what we're looking at now is about a quarter of all the mammals, a third of all the amphibians, and about 15% of all the birds on the planet are threatened with extinction at this stage. And we also are pushing up really hard on the climate change arena. And then finally, one interesting area is really related to the nitrogen cycle. And basically, we were able to feed an ever-growing population with the development and use of ever-increasing amounts of artificial fertilizer based on the fixing of nitrogen. And we are starting to see that that's having a major impact on our oceans. And the scientists are actually arguing that we have to substantially reduce the amount of nitrogen that we're putting into the system if we're going to maintain the integrity of it. So we're bumping up against these planetary boundaries. They're not really – people don't like to think of them as really as limits to growth, because the reality is that we have to continue to grow. We have to continue to provide jobs for ever-growing numbers of people. We have to be able to meet the need for better life, particularly of the 3 billion people at the bottom of our societies. But we have to do it in a way that doesn't exceed these boundaries. The other problem is we're running out of time. 40 years ago, we could talk about climate change, sustainability, and I used to think this was an issue that I was working on for my grandchildren. But the reality is that we just don't have another 20, 30 years to argue about abstractions and to set grand goals. We really have to start acting. And I've excerpted sort of a part of an amazing speech that was given by Ban Ki-moon in Davos in January, and basically where he said that, you know, that our current economic model just simply doesn't work, and climate change is evidence of that. And he actually called for a free market revolution for global sustainability. And he said if we don't change the direction we're heading, we're really heading towards a national disasters. Third big shift is really in the nature of power on the planet. This is a photograph that was taken during the Copenhagen negotiations of the climate treaty. And at the center, you see President Obama with his Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, next to him. And this picture was taken in a side room where President Obama was doing direct negotiations with the leaders of China, India, South Africa, and Brazil. And in some ways, if you look at the planet and the future of the planet, it is going to be those four countries and a few others in the developing world where most of the growth is going to occur in the next 20 or 30 years. And so the United States really has to work with those countries to make sure that they can continue to grow, but do it in a way that doesn't overwhelm the capacity of the planet otherwise. The other big shift is really from our traditional way of looking at the world from international law and geopolitical, where the world is kind of neatly divided amongst nation states, and they're the only recognized actors. There used to be about 50 of them, and the idea was you'd get them all in a room, and as illustrated here, they'd write a treaty and a problem would be taken care of. Today we have 192 countries, and of all shapes and sizes, but theoretically they all have one vote and they're all equal. And I like to remind my colleagues in Washington, D.C., you think it's hard to get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate? Try and get 192 votes in any negotiation, which is one of the reasons why the Copenhagen negotiations collapsed and why it's so difficult today to get countries to agree to anything very, very specific. So what we need is sort of a new model. And the model we need is really a model that looks more like the real world, which is global in structure, where I use the term internetal or between networks. Governments are still really critical, but it's not just national governments. It's also state and local governments. We have to figure out a way to engage with international agencies, with corporations, with organizations, with media and citizens. I was recently at a meeting where a gentleman from Unilever, which is a big multinational corporation based in the United Kingdom, made the point that every day Unilever sells something to 2 billion people on the planet. Walmart has a billion employees. It's the biggest retailer on the planet, but they're not. They don't have a seat in negotiation. But the reality is, in terms of their economic and environmental impact, it's probably more important than all but a handful of the countries that are actually engaged in these negotiations. So we need a different kind of model, a network model, and that's starting to happen. There are now hundreds of what people are calling global action networks. We're actually starting to get political scientists to start looking at this phenomena, where you have governments coming together with international agencies, corporations, NGOs to actually work on specific problems. And and let me just talk very briefly about two of them that are significant. One is the Partnership for Clean Fuels and Vehicles that actually NRDC is part of. It was founded 10 years ago. And the goal was to phase out leaded gasoline around the world and to reduce the sulfur in diesels. And it's been extraordinarily successful. And I think we're actually getting fairly close to a world in which there's no leaded gasoline used anywhere on the planet as a result of this partnership. And there's no treaty, no plan of action. The other is the Clinton Global Initiative. Bill Clinton came to the conclusion that he said, I'd been to too many international meetings where everybody sits around and sets grand goals for where we're going to be 10 years ago, and then they go home and do nothing. So he says, you can't come to the Clinton Global Initiative unless you're willing to do something. And over the last 6 years, he's managed to get 2,000 commitments worth about $6 billion involving all kinds of projects over a broad range of areas in about 170 countries infecting hundreds of millions of people. So it's a really kind of exciting model, which, you know, could hopefully would get even greater currency in the years ahead. All right, so we're just 7 months away now from Rio. And it's kind of, we're really at an interesting time. This meeting, you know, what I've tried to lay out here a little bit are some of the obstacles and the opportunities. What's interesting is that even though we're 7 months away, I can't tell you exactly what's going to happen because the governments themselves don't know. They've had two preparatory meetings, and they're going to be meeting again in December. But things are still very, very much up in the air, and there are some reasons for that. One is all the easy stuff's been done. You know, they can't write any more treaties. You know, they've written dozens and dozens of plans of action, so they're having a hard time figuring out what to do. The other problem is we really haven't had much leadership from governments. Brazilians, President Lula, the former president of Brazil, was very enthusiastic about this meeting. He left office a year ago. His successor, President Rousseff, she's engaged, but we haven't seen real leadership from the Brazilians or anyone else. And then another problem is there's a lot of skepticism today about leadership generally, I think is reflected in the Occupy movement. But there's particularly a lot of skepticism about the ability of the international system to deliver very much. And particularly after the debacle in Copenhagen in December of 2009, you've had many of the major civil society organizations, big environmental groups, big humanitarian groups, kind of holding back a little bit. In my mind, while these are obstacles, there's also huge opportunities. Because the governments are holding back, it's really an opportunity for civil society, for citizens to really drive the agenda, to really, you know, sort of create the kind of expectations about what we want our leaders to do at that meeting. We also have the potential to use social media. When I was in Rio in 1992, one of the most exciting things for me was the fact that I actually saw a cell phone. I had never really seen or used one, but that was one case where the developing world had leapfrogged the industrialized world. There were actually many more cell phones in use in 1992 in Brazil than there were in the United States, and I can remember how exciting it was to hold this phone and be able to call my wife back in Washington, D.C. And today we got 2 billion people that are connected to the Internet. We have about 5 billion people that have cell phones, 5 billion We have about 4 billion people with cell phones. So we have that potential to reach people in a way that didn't exist. And we really have an opportunity to sort of say to folks, the time for talk is over, and we really have to get actions on these critical issues by every country, community, and corporation on the planet. All right, so here are some of the deliverables, some of the things we'd like to see, and we have a much longer list. but here's just the beginning of some of the things we'd like to see come out of Rio. Not negotiated necessarily, but we'd like to see individual countries, individually, collectively, move on some of these issues along with subnational governments, corporations, and other stakeholders. We got to move beyond GDP as a measure of progress. I mean, it's clear that our current economic system isn't working. We have to figure out ways to value natural capital, ecosystem services. Work's been going on in this area for a long time. We've got to get governments to move more quickly. 3 years ago, the G20, which is the group of the major economies on the planet, said they'd do something about phasing out fossil fuel subsidies. We got to start doing that. We have to really reduce the amount of money that we're actually. I think we're spending about $400 or $500 billion a year around the world on subsidizing both the production and use of fossil fuels. It's time for a global effort to eliminate inefficient incandescent light bulbs. We have to be encouraging countries around the world to really step up their investments in energy efficiency and renewables. We have to curb the use and disposal of single-use plastic bags as part of a comprehensive effort to deal with plastics in the ocean. And, you know, and then finally, it seems like a small thing, but, you know, the state of California went ahead and took efforts moving towards banning shark finning and trade. And so why don't we have as a goal making this worldwide by next June? Now, this is just a short representative list, but if you can imagine if as a result of this summit we made progress on these sorts of issues, you know, I think a lot of us would give us a lot of hope that we really do can remake the world in a way that's going to be much better than the one that we have now. So what can you do? You really have to act locally. You know, I think it's time to start asking questions. What can San Francisco and the state of California bring to the Earth Summit? The thing is, there's a lot of really exciting things going on, at experimental levels or low levels. We have to figure out how do we ratchet things up. We have to really start thinking creatively about how the challenges we face and how we can use new technologies and approaches to make a difference. What are your ideas about what should come out of the Earth Summit? You can actually go up to www.uncsd2012.org and give the UN your idea about what you'd like to see the international community deliver at Rio. And then finally, we have to really demand leadership, and we really have to assure that President Obama and other leaders come to Rio either physically or virtually and make commitments to real action. So let me finish with this point. There was a State Department official who said, you know, this meeting should be called Rio Plus 20. It should really be called Rio for 20-somethings because you have a whole new generation of people that have come of age since the first Earth Summit. There are roughly 3 billion people on the planet that are less than 25 years old. And this meeting, next June, will set sort of the tone and substance of how we think and talk about sustainability, about the relationship between the environment, economics, and equity for the next 10 to 20 years. And it will determine whether or not we really do something about these problems. The Race to Rio is something that we're all involved in. It's something that, you know, in some ways we either all win or all lose. But I'm really hopeful, I'm really optimistic that we can make the Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit a success, and we can move the world towards a more sustainable future. Thank you very, very much.
I'd like to remind our listening audience that you're listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speaker has been Jacob Scher of the NRDC. And the program topic is Rio Plus 20 Earth Summit, moving forward with sustainable development around the world. And our next speaker is Jared Blumenfeld, who is with the EPA.
Thanks, Carrie. Thanks, Anne. And Jacob has been he's a great mentor. When I came out of law school, I had focused at the Sierra Club Legal Defense Fund here in San Francisco on the human rights and environment connection. And I met Jacob at a party in Washington, D.C., and he had just got a grant from the Ford Foundation. And the next day I went to work for him. And he really is, I mean, I was talking to my colleagues at the State Department, EPA, and I said, So who's involved in the Rio Plus 20 discussion? I mean, what environmental groups? And they were like, well, there's Jacob. I was like, Jacob's just one person. And they were like, yeah, but it's really Jacob that's helping define this debate. I know Tom Butler has a similar experience. He works at EPA now, too. Both of us learned a huge amount from Jacob, and he's really someone that focuses on getting stuff done. So it's an honor to have him here today and a thrill to be on the panel with him. So I'm in a kind of different role than I was at the last Earth Summit. Actually, the very first Earth Summit was in 1972 in Stockholm, and then the second one was in Rio, and then in Johannesburg, and now in Rio again. And many of the things have been really said by Jacob very articulately, but I'll focus on a few things that the U.S. government is doing, and then we can open it up for questions. So the first thing is that the U.S. government position on, you know, our formal State Department position will be published on the 1st of November. So right now everything I'm saying is leading up to that. And really that's an opportunity for all of you to shape that debate. It's great that Jacob's shaping the debate, but if the 50 of you in this room can send emails and ideas to the State Department, they have a special website set up. If you just Google State Department Rio Plus 20, you'll get that site. So much of what we're really hoping today is to galvanize enthusiasm and effort around what we need to do as the U.S. government at Rio Plus 20. So EPA is not the lead agency. It's the State Department, which really speaks to some of the things Jacob was talking about. We ultimately would be implementing and along with other U.S. government agencies accountable for getting the results done. And that's one thing that really does distinguish the United States. And we don't see that until we enter the international debate. But when we agree to something, we want to make sure it's actually implemented. And many people come to these conferences and really just feel good about signing things that never are implemented. And when I first came to Washington, D.C. in 92, Jacob gave me this report written by the General Accounting Office on the effectiveness of multilateral, which means agreements beyond two parties on the environment. So if you can imagine things like the Convention on the International Trade in Endangered Species, transboundary movement of hazardous waste, biodiversity, oil spill reduction, the list goes on and on. At the time, there was about 250 agreements, international agreements. Now there's about 450. So there's a huge increase in the number of agreements, but as Jacob pointed out, the global environment hasn't got noticeably better. In fact, most indicators point in the wrong direction. So this General Accounting Office report said, what are, out of the 250 agreements that existed in 92, how many are effective? How many are working well? And it said three. Three were working well, and those three were the only three that required mandatory reporting, actually required that you report on what you were doing to implement the obligations. The only one that had sanctions was the Convention on the International Trade of Endangered Species. I happened to be on a delegation in Harare to the CITES meeting, and you realize if that was an effective treaty, we're really in trouble. So I think the U.S. government, the first thing that we recognize is that we do not need any more international agreements. And so the U.S. government will not be pushing for more international agreements. We have enough on the books. We need to implement the ones that are already in existence. What we need is action. So exactly what Jacob is pushing is really what the Obama administration and the State Department will be pushing, and certainly EPA, which is how do we get stuff done? And it seems, you know, in a city like San Francisco, we have former commissioners like Darian and others in the audience, you know how to get things done, and many of the things on Jacob's list have been done. You did ban plastic bags. You know, you have focused on getting to zero waste. We've focused on things that really were tangible. So the model, the city model, really needs to be heard. C40, many of you were involved in World Environment Day in 2005. It marked the 60th anniversary of the founding of the United Nations. We're now 66 years on. That was in San Francisco. many people in San Francisco, my kids are both in the public school system here, no one teaches that the United Nations was founded in San Francisco. We have a special obligation and duty to make sure that our concern for the environment and our continued belief on the ability to work with other nations continues. But it can't be only through this multilateral treaty framework that hasn't proved effective, and I really don't believe will prove effective. So rather than focusing on what the percentage reduction of greenhouse gas emissions should be, why don't we focus on things that have worked in California, like a renewable portfolio standard? We came out with a global renewable portfolio standard. Each country agrees to what it can do. That makes sense. The citizens understand it. That's the other problem, is that we have completely lost the public on these international treaties. No one in this room, even Jacob, could really tell you what was being negotiated in Copenhagen, let alone where the failures were and how they could be resolved. So when you make it so complicated that you lose the public, the politicians who were really not held very accountable before have no accountability at all, because they can kind of muddle by in the sea of confusion. So Jacob's point, phasing out lead and gasoline, you know if that's happened. And if you can't phase out lead and gasoline, or if you can't ban plastic bags, it's extraordinarily difficult to put cap and trade system for carbon dioxide. If you don't have the political will to do those very basic steps, it's going to be very difficult to do the more difficult things. So cities are actually a focus that I think EPA and the U.S. government is going to focus on at the Rio Plus 20. They're generally not stakeholders in the global process, but after World Environment Day, many cities, about 110 now, signed on to something called the Urban Environmental Accords, which are commonsensical action items that every city could take in a reasonable period of time. I think it was 7 years. There's actually just a conference, I think, happened last week in Korea to focus on what has happened to those commitments. But you can tell what's happened, is the point. Many of these things, you have no idea what's happened. So cities are a great frame to galvanize the public. And the nice thing about cities is they all share very many things. You've all got to turn on the water faucet and get clean water out. You've got to be able to plug in your devices and get energy that serves those light bulbs to cell phones. You have to run public transportation systems to avoid congestion. And the list goes on and on and on. You have to have parks for people to go to get away from the noise and heat of the city. So cities actually have a great deal in common that countries don't. The city of New York and the city of Beijing have a great deal more in common than the country of the United States and the country of China. And so there's an ability to get agreement, and mayors are held accountable by you. You hold your mayor accountable. It's very, very difficult to hold a national government accountable. You have to go to Washington, D.C. You have to get a meeting. Many of you could go to the Board of Supervisors and push an item that you care about. Anne was talking at the beginning of the meeting about how do we recycle coat hangers. If we can't recycle coat hangers, it's going to be difficult to solve some of these very large issues of biodiversity. So one of the things Lisa Jackson, my boss, the administrator of EPA, has done is a U.S.-Brazil joint initiative on urban sustainability. She signed it in August this year. And not only will Rio be hosting the Earth Summit next year, they'll then be hosting the Olympics and then be hosting the World Cup. So we partnered with the city of Philadelphia. I have no idea why. I was like, do you not know about San Francisco? I was like, what has Philadelphia done recently for environment? But I figured they're close to D.C., right? We're far from D.C., so that must be one of the reasons. But Mayor Nutter has done a great deal in Philadelphia. He's partnering with the mayor of Rio de Janeiro, and we're looking at everything from how you put in real standards to reduce air pollutants to how you deal with issues of waste. But very simple concepts. California just upped its requirement AB 939, which was adopted in 1989, required all jurisdictions get to 50% recycling rate. The Jerry Brown just signed a requirement that we get to 75% recycling rate. The number of jobs that would be created is significant. For every one job that you create when you send material to the landfill, you create 10 if you recycle that material. It's a really easy way to get jobs. This is a lot about the green economy, so thinking about jobs is critical to the success of what comes out of Rio Plus 20 from a U.S. government perspective. We want actions, we want it focused as much as possible on local action, and we want green jobs and green technology to come out of it. So that's a pretty ambitious agenda. You have people coming in from everywhere on the planet. There's a lot of excitement, but really what we found, what Jacob and I found, is this implementation gap. After the enthusiasm and the fanfare and the champagne bottles stop popping, you need to get something done. And getting something done is what the planet needs. And it's only going to happen if you hold me and other government officials accountable for getting it done. So the job ahead in the next 10 days is really to get the word out through your networks that you can make a difference, because if each one of you came up with one great idea, if Emily said, let's ban plastic bags, and Jacob said the same thing, now you have like five people on the website, and that may be the only five people on the website that talk about what we should be doing at Rio Plus 20, because this isn't one of those, this isn't the Keystone XL pipeline. There isn't a huge community that understands the issue and feels passionate about it. That doesn't mean it's not deserving of that same attention. It's just very difficult to get people to focus on international agreements at a time when we're struggling locally and nationally. So to me, this really does have an important role to play in capitals around the world. When we looked at what happened after the Rio Earth Summit, what we found was that things like Agenda 21, this framework for sustainable development, were actually being taken to local city councils, to board of supervisors, and people came out with action plans that they never would have come out with if a document as aspirational as it was hadn't been signed in Rio. So it doesn't matter how legally binding it is. What really matters is how much action it motivates at the other end, and really you can help make it more effective than it would be without your participation. So really this is an issue that many people care about once they understand, but it takes San Francisco know-how, and many of you in this room, looking around the room, have spent a lot of time thinking about how do we make this amorphous environmental movement into something that individual people can care about, that you can measure, and that hopefully can create jobs out the other end. And this is an opportunity that affords that success if you get involved. Thank you.
He always wanted to do that.
Yeah. That's right. Kerry said if I came, I could hit the gavel.
Right. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California on the subject of Rio Plus 20. Our speakers have been Jared Blumenfeld and Jacob Scher. And now it's time for audience questions, and I'd lead off with one while you're all thinking of yours. Oh, wait a minute. People have already thought of theirs. So I'm going to go to the first audience question.
Thank you so much. I was very interested in your discussion of what governments can do and cannot do, and very much interested in the whole role of industries. And when you mentioned Walmart had a billion employees.
A million.
Got me to thinking.
A million.
A billion would be a lot of employees.
That would be a lot. A million would do. But the question is, how can we suggest or encourage the industries to do things that we clearly need to have done? You talked about incandescent light bulbs. Somebody manufactures and distributes and markets incandescent light bulbs. But could they not manufacture, distribute, and make money off of other types of light bulbs that are much more environmentally friendly. And what we really need in the world, back to your very first slide, is we need safe, effective, available, cheap family planning. Now, some pharmaceutical companies make and manufacture and distribute.
If there may have been a question in there. Would either of you like to?
Jacob only has two kids, so.
All right, next question.
Oh, there was a question in there. I can.
Oh, okay.
In terms of a great example, something that I've been looking at is goods movement. So within California, about 40% of all containerized goods into the United States come into the ports of L.A., Long Beach, and Oakland. And they impact environmental justice communities, they impact our freeways, and they lead to the worst air pollution in the United States, which California still has. Walmart came out with an idea of reducing their packaging by 5% in 5 years, and they're saving $3 billion from doing it. But more importantly, they're reducing the amount of trucks on the road. They're reducing the amount of plastic that goes into the ocean, and it's an incredibly powerful thing to do. So just saying, how can we reduce packaging? The knock-on effects of doing one thing like that are really incredible. And if you have a company like Walmart that has a very large supply chain, you can do great things. The issue is that not everyone is going to do that unless it becomes a law. So leveling the playing field is really what EPA is about. We want to make sure that our laws apply to all oil companies, not just the ones that are doing progressive stuff, because the small ones that don't have that environmental ethic can cause very, very large problems. So you have industry leaders, and the things that they do need to somehow be highlighted, but at the same time, we need to think about how to make them more universal. So at the moment, companies are certainly leading the way on much of this, but it's not all companies.
So a question for each of you. Jacob, I know that the Corporate Eco Forum and its 80 or so members are going to be doing voluntary commitments mm-hmm. similar to the Clinton Initiative down there. Are you aware of any other is Clinton going to be down there and their group around voluntary commitments? I think that's a very powerful mechanism from the corporate sector. And then for Jared, very curious about what's the next step with the cities program between the U.S. and Brazil, and how could we bring an effective cities engagement to Rio Plus 20?
Well, let me, you made the point about voluntary commitments, and let me just, I think it's important sometimes, a little bit of confusion sometimes. People often talk about the difference between legally binding and non-legally binding, or hard or soft law. And the reality is when you deal with nation states, it's all voluntary. And I understand it, I'm just saying that in a sense, the language, you have to be careful, because the reality is, yes, I mean, I think I think we will see a lot of cities going to Rio, mayors and governors, and I think we will see a number of CEOs. And what we're trying to do is kind of create the expectation that people will come to Rio and use it as a forum for making, you know, significant commitments to sort of take what they're doing to a higher level, to a larger scale. And items that we're working on is the notion of trying to create some sort of new international registry of sustainability commitments, so that we really try and be able to sort of monitor these commitments, to aggregate them, to assess them, and so that people feel a greater degree of accountability for making these promises. But I think this is going to be at the center of what happens in Rio, or at least I hope it is. That, you know, the goal would be that, you know, if the Clinton Global Initiative took 6 years to produce $6 billion worth of commitments, why don't we shoot for several hundred million, if not trillions of dollars of commitments by companies and corporations and communities and countries around the world to actually do something about the problems that we face?
The agreement between Rio and and Brazil and EPA is going to be fleshed out. So we're going to have a work plan that will be on the web at the end of this month, and there'll be very concrete things that come out of that specific thing, but that, those obviously are not the full breadth of what cities can do at the Rio Plus 10. So C40, which is headed by Mayor Bloomberg, is certainly, I think, going to play a powerful role in the Rio meetings, and I've been to a few of those meetings, and they're very focused on what can actually be done and how we can, you know, bypass compact fluorescents and go right to LED streetlights. How can we provide the services to cities in a bundled way, and some of it through the Clinton Global Initiative, to make stuff happen? So it's really less about the fanfare and more about what are those connections. And so I think Jacob's right. There'll be a lot of mayors there, and there'll be forum both formally and outside. A lot of the buzz in Rio was actually outside the formal conference. And here again, I think a lot of the action will be in the, you know, whether it's TED or C40 or other social networks coming together around the event. So to me, that's where the action will happen.
Hi, I'm wondering if you can maybe flesh out a little bit more, Jacob, when you were making your introductory comments and you were talking about some of the different possible deliverables and campaigns mm-hmm. that could come out of Rio, and I love where you were heading in terms of moving beyond just the multilateral national level agreements. I agree that the subnational, the corporate, et cetera, engagement is going to be crucial to getting something done. But what I'm wondering is how does that actually happen in terms of is it just a bunch of people show up to Rio and then they come up with these agreements on the spot? Or what does the effort look like ahead of time to identify and kind of put some meat on the bone for each of these different initiatives, hopefully use those as a hook to recruit people to get there so that they know the conversations that are already going to happen ahead of time can hopefully have some commitments available, and ideally, you know, you leverage the peer pressure of everybody yeah. signing on to ban shark finning as well as ban plastic bags, et cetera, and have, you know, multiple different initiatives happening, hopefully several of which would actually get some traction. So what does that look like, and how can we help?
Well, I think you did a pretty good job of sort of outlining how we want it to happen. I mean, what we're trying to do is basically put out this vision of a different kind of summit, and we'll be submitting our comments on November 1st to the UN. The first sort of negotiating session will be in mid-December, and we'll be pushing this idea of deliverables. And part of it, sort of saying, a simple way to put it is that rather than coming up with a global action plan, is really to ask people to come up with their individual to-do lists. And so, we're trying our best just to sort of, it's a modest goal, but to basically transform the way the international system, deals with these kinds of meetings. Like, for example, one of the features of a summit is that each president and prime minister is given 5 minutes to speak. And, what we want to try and do is get the UN to actually provide a little template, because if you actually read those speeches, they're actually fascinating. They're kind of an indication of, in some ways, it gives you great hope and some great concern about the level of leadership on the planet. But you could imagine, and many of them are very theoretical or they're pointing fingers at somebody else, but you can imagine if each president and prime minister got up and said, I'm the president of so-and-so country and my major obligation is to my people, but they are human beings, they're part of this larger problem, and here are the five things that I'm going to do in the next few years to deal with sustainability, and here's where I need help, and here's where I can give help. I think that would be an amazing change. And so we're kind of laying out that vision, and we need a lot of help. I've been working now, as Jared said, I've been working very, very hard in trying to get people to think about how we want the summit to be structured. And so I've been working with a lot of different communities. I've been working with people involved in governance. I've worked with people involved in population and family planning, the oceans community. And with each one of these communities, I've sort of said, what are the deliverables that you want so that when we start actually engaging with governments and we get further along in this process over the next few months and governments start thinking about what they're going to bring to Rio, that we can hopefully use that period between now and Rio to actually get people to figure out what those commitments are and then announce them in Rio. Once we get to Rio, the political will goes down. But if we get presidents and prime ministers, CEOs, mayors, governors to commit, you know, then at that point we can start feeding in these ideas. So I'm hopeful, but it's a big challenge because there's a tremendous amount of inertia in the system, and you know, but I think it's a real challenge for the United Nations and for leadership today. And so I'm still hopeful. Yeah.
I have a question, Jacob. Sure. I don't know if you'd be willing to share. I'm curious what countries and companies you'd like to see more engaged in what we're talking about today. And I was also interested knowing a little bit more about the international registry that you mentioned.
Okay. I mentioned in my talk about the fact that Ban Ki-moon had called for a free market revolution for global sustainability. Unfortunately, somebody asked me to define that once, and I really couldn't. But it's really the notion that, what I think he was saying was that it's not one or other. It's not one country or another country. I mean, part of it is that we really have to kind of both create kind of a sense of urgency and awareness on the part of billions of people that we live on this small planet, and we are getting too crowded, and it's getting depleted. And that if we don't change what we're doing, that we have to be worried about what kind of future particularly our children and grandchildren are going to have. And at the same time, you know, we have to create a real sense of hope, in part by empowering people to really, you know, make changes in their own lives and in their own communities, their own corporations. And so part of the registry idea is that one of the challenges we have today is we all know that there's a lot of really good things going on. But the problem is that there's no way to really see it. It's not aggregated and reported on. And, for example, if you read the newspapers in the United States, you think the only thing that the Obama administration has done on solar power, the only thing going on in the entire country in solar power is this one debacle with Solyndra. And, you know, and so I think that, so part of the challenge is, and I've been reaching out a lot to media professionals, is that how do you tell this story? The problem is the real world looks a lot more like the Internet than it does the international system. So you have a lot of small things going on, and it adds up to something big, but it's very, very difficult to see. And so if anybody in this audience has any great ideas about how to deal with that communications problem, please, you know, talk to me. Because it's really critical. Yeah.
Good evening. Thanks for being here. My question has to do more with the deliverables mm-hmm. on poverty and tying sure. poverty alleviation to the whole global. You know, how do we're talking about all of these things, but there's not really talking about sustainability as far as social enterprise mm-hmm. and social innovation, and then how do we get everybody in having an inclusive an equitable system. Could you speak to that?
No, I mean, eradicating poverty and social equity is absolutely central to the concept of sustainability. And, what I've been saying to people about this Earth Summit is it's a platform. And, you know, and people say, well, you know, my issue is not being addressed. Well, you know, something... What you got to do then is get yourself organized and start putting in the agenda. I can tell you it's interesting that the Occupy Wall Street movement has gotten people's attention, and it's really put the social equity issue on the agenda. If you saw what happened in the Arab world in the springtime, it really is about a demographic shift that's going on in the world where all of a sudden you see millions of young people in their teens and 20s looking at their prospects and saying, wow, the society is not providing jobs, not providing entrepreneurial opportunities, and putting a tremendous amount of pressure on leadership. And so I think that it's going to be interesting to see. I've been really heartened by the fact that we've seen, you know, much more activism on the part of people that are concerned about social equity issues, and that I think it will be a bigger part of the agenda. But then you get to the question of actually what you do about it. And I think one of the interesting dynamics that has been present in so many of the earlier meetings, and it's not going to be present here, is that, you know, one was that often these meetings work because there were pledges of billions of dollars to flow from north to south. That's not going to happen. And at the end of the day, it's really going to be up to, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But the neat division between developed and developing world isn't there anymore. And we got to get over that. You know, we live in this kind of globalized society, and you have north and south, developed and developing world in every country. And so I think it's one of these other paradigm shifts that we're going to have to deal with. So it's going to be a very, very interesting period coming up.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
I have a question regarding the importance of clean technologies and all of this.
Okay, sure.
I am a skilled young chemist, and I know myself and a lot of people I know would be eager to have a green job, but they're just not around. And given the lack of confidence in the leadership in our government and all of the negative attention that Solyndra has gotten, how will you approach this in the conference? Perhaps you could do something with the citywide initiative and foster some collaboration with willing people in cities to collaborate on some technology or some work.
So it's a great question, and hopefully you find EPA, because we have a need for lots of chemists. I just came from a conference with 147 tribal nations in the three states that I cover, and we have these social inclusion issues right here in this country. So it is not it's not like this is a foreign problem, and it's not like the jobs issue just applies here or somewhere else. You know, it's happening today, right now, and the answers need to be proven somewhere. So the real benefit of a conference like this is that we don't have all the answers. We think we do, but we really don't. And one of the great humbling experiences is you may find out that Burkina Faso has an amazing program, or that Mozambique or Bangladesh will likely have thought through some of these issues in a way that we have not. So the answer to a professional environmental training that you have really is standards. If you have standards that promote innovation. So at the moment, EPA is under attack for having these standards that protect human health and the environment. Those standards, like the Clean Air Act, have created things like the catalytic converter. They've required that we monitor our water to make sure it meets clean water standards. And so standards really allow people to understand what the requirements are and find out if you've met them or not, and that requires environmental professionals. So more than anything else, really it's innovation, it's pushing to say how do we get to the next level of improvement. That requires people to want to get there, to understand the benefits of getting there, and that you need environmental professionals to do the work in between. So we have to solve the problems in our local economy to be able to bring something to the table in Rio. But we also need to be open enough to the ideas that some other countries may have thought of these problems. And I think that's really what we're trying to do with Brazil and with Rio, is to say they may have many more alternative fuel vehicles than we do. They do.
They do.
Right? So how do we learn from them rather than the current thinking that existed in 92, which is we only have things to teach.
Okay. Go ahead. Yep.
In terms of the timetable that one questioner asked about, by November 1st, you are required to submit your plans. So I think that should be made clear here. NGOs, industry, government, and therefore there's a hard deadline coming up for anyone that does want to submit.
Sure.
After that, there will be discussion, as was mentioned, and by January 1st will be the zero draft, and that will then go into negotiations.
Right.
Now, in terms of cities, I have been involved in an important document the UN is putting out, the Department of Economic and Social Affairs, on October 31st. It's called the Shanghai Manual for Sustainable Cities, and that is going to be a blueprint for mayors and economic development leaders looking at case studies from around the world, Bangladesh, India, Brazil, North America, Europe, Asia, about what's being done. And that is part of a policy position the UN is putting out on the road to Rio.
Right. The November 1st deadline is a deadline for submission from outside parties to the UN about what they want to see in terms of results from the summit. But, you know, and then, you know, and then it'll all be digested, and then there will be a negotiated document. Our hope is that that document is about 10 pages long, that it's very brief, and because you've got to give the negotiator something to do, and that we really get people to focus more on the sorts of things I've been talking about, these to-do lists, these partnerships, these global action networks. And we'll see if that happens, because I think, you know, because there will be pressure to create new sustainable development goals, and you know, if left to its own, and this is where it's really important for the public to kind of weigh in, to sort of say, we don't want you to spend a lot of taxpayers' money on developing another 150-page plan of action. We've started making some initial estimates about the cost of this entire exercise. It's going to be, you know, about $500 million, which compared to the Olympics or World Cup isn't much, but it's still a major investment. And so I think it's reasonable to use that as a metric against which we would measure the results. And if all we get out of it is 150 pages of abstract promises, people should be very, very disappointed. I think this is an extraordinarily important test for the United Nations. And, you know, I'd really encourage anybody who has the time or effort to even send a very, very brief email to the UN sort of saying, you know, the time for talk is over. We really want you to structure this meeting as a meeting where people come to commit to actually do something very, very specific and concrete.
Okay. You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speakers are Jacob Scher of the NRDC and Jared Blumenfeld of the EPA. And now we come to the point in our program where we have just time for one last question.
Thank you. I just made some observations. I think children will help establish a global movement. I think some of the MBAs who have majored in earth preservation subjects can be very important. Okay. In terms of corporations, I think you have a good point. Last week, Nike sponsored a women's marathon. 22,000 people participated. Hold on a second. And part of the funding will go for leukemia research. So from what you have said, the earth is getting sick, and we all need to clean it up in a multitude of ways. What you are asking for is action. The question then becomes, how do you create that action? And it seems that far more dynamic relationships and structures need to be created.
Here.
Yeah. Okay. So is that a yes?
Yes.
All right, we'll have one more question.
Has anybody thought about making this fun? Instead of a, that's not
it's
a
in
joke.
Rio.
It's in instead, Rio.
In, right.
No, I don't mean individual. It could be individual fun, but if instead of this being top down, what if you involved communities to have you know what has to be done. So if you itemize 5 or 10 items that have to be done, and then you evaluate what communities, and then what like maybe each district in the city of San Francisco, what have they done to take it to one level? They should get accolades for that and rewards for that. Then the city of San Francisco can compete with Philadelphia and New York, et cetera. And then you make it like a Miss Universe contest and have these cute little chicks saying, well, South Korea did this, and you have a sliding scale. And you really make it a Vegas show to clean up the environment. I think you'd get a lot more participation and a lot more enthusiasm by making it a game where you can win something. And then have it an international, like a Miss Universe, just have it a Miss Environmental person.
No, I think, that's the kind of thing, that's really interesting, because I think one of the things we've been trying to do is sort of link in people's minds the Earth Summit to the World Cup and to the Olympics. And in a sense, that's why we call our campaign Race to Rio, and our hope is that we really can create, you know, competition around the world that would begin now and then start really get started in June of 2012 and then sort of work through the World Cup and the Olympics, and really, you know, in the next 4 or 5 years, really get us onto a much more sustainable path. And I think you're right. We have to figure out a way to really engage people, and we're really struggling with how do we particularly engage young people
Facebook.
In something. Facebook, yes, okay.
I just like, since I get the last word, I think this has been really fun, and I want to thank all of you and Jacob for coming.
Thank you all.
Yes.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. Our speakers have been Jacob Scher and Jared Blumenfeld, speaking on Rio Plus 20, the upcoming Global Sustainability Summit. And now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you are in the know, is adjourned.